I just want to thank everybody for reading again. Thank you. And again, welcome to people that have joined us since we first started. And a particular welcome to any newcomers and visitors with us this evening. We hope you hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back to Narcotics Anonymous. So we do have a speaker this evening who's going to share for 40 or 45 minutes on their experience, strength and hope. And it falls for me to introduce them. And this particular individual is kind of revisiting our group for the first time in quite a few years. In a funny kind of way, we were joking about it when I spoke to her yesterday that the part of our history and was the first one of the first people that we ever kind of bring live into an event, a land-based convention in the UK some years ago. And so I'm delighted that she's agreed to come and share with us again this evening. And without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to Laura. So, Laura, please share with us. Thank you.
Okay, I am muted. Let's see. All right, can you hear me now?
Indeed, we can.
Okay, I'm not familiar with this platform, and so I have screwed up already, which is as good an introduction as any. My name is Laura. I'm an addict. I
Hi,
came to AA.
Laura.
Hi,
Hi,
Laura.
Hi,
Laura.
Welcome. Thank
Welcome.
you.
Hello.
Welcome.
And my clean date is December 21st, 1971. That is 1971. That means I have 48 years clean. And I used to talk a lot about, my life before recovery, but it's much more exciting to talk about what's happened since I got clean. And okay. And I was praying yesterday. I really like to share what people need to hear. And so I'm going to take a minute and ask God to guide my words. And the first thing I was thinking about was what it was like when I first got clean. I went to a I just tell you, I was a school teacher at that time, and I had a master's degree. And I want you to picture this. I had one entire wall of my living room full of books. And I went to a beginner's meeting, and this guy said, "I'm so glad I'm dumb. The intellectuals don't make it." And I got so scared because I knew that this program was going to save my life. I got so scared that I dropped every large vocabulary word from my speech, and I hung out with people from the street. And my boyfriend became, I chose a guy as my first boyfriend in recovery, as someone from the street. And I did that because in those days it was my thinking that maybe he would allow me to stay here. And of course today I know that that's bullshit. And I hope it's okay, as I'm going to curse, and I do. And the second thing I thought about was I don't know, about 3 or 4 years ago, I sponsored a woman for a little while who got clean at about the same age I did. I was 26 years old, and she too was a professional woman. She had a degree and a profession and a license and all kinds of stuff. Only in her life, she didn't stay clean. And she did a written first step with me and read it to me, and what that told me was what my life would have been like if I hadn't stayed clean. And when I first, when I came here, I lived in this almost empty apartment that my cousin and people she knew rented for me and moved some furniture in. And not very much. I mean, I remember trying to hang curtains, and I couldn't hang the curtains. And so it was a mess. I lived in a mess because I was unable to put things together anymore. So 3 or 4 years ago, I sponsored this woman, and she started out as a professional, and slowly her life, she got fired from her job, and she went to jail, and then she prostituted herself, and then she went to jail again. And this long misery, this long years of misery that I didn't have to experience. And I'm overwhelmed at times at the life that I've been given. I will say that I'm old now. Now, I came in at 26, 48 years later, I'm 74. My hair is gray, not dark brown. And I've had cancer. I don't know, I've had four or five different cancers and three different chemotherapies, and I know today that this program allowed me to stay clean through all of that. So let me go back in my head and talk about what it was like in the beginning. I come from a really abusive family life. Most of my family were not addicts, they were gamblers. And gamblers can be really sleazy, just so you know. And my grandpa lost all his money, and my uncle arranged with the people he owed money to sell two of us girls to child pornographers. And so that was my early life, was of being really sex trafficking and being really abused. And the awful thing about abuse isn't necessarily what happens in the moment. It's the way people treat you afterwards to justify what nasty shit they did. And so my family treated me like I was worthless. And the abuse stopped, the active abuse stopped when I was 10. I will tell you that when I was 10 is when I started on drugs. And I was primarily a prescription drug addict, although at the end I was in Los Angeles, I was working several free clinics and several doctors. So, but I used prescriptions and whatever else you gave me when I was around other people. And when I was 10, I started on diet pills. And then when you take diet pills, you can't sleep. So I had sleeping pills. And when you take diet pills, you get real nervous. And so I had tranquilizers. And that went on pretty much until I got clean. And although I switched, I don't know when it was. I guess I was 21 or 22 when the FDA changed the way they rated amphetamines, and that now you had, they were now a class something or other drug, and it was harder to get. But at any rate, I used drugs all through high school, all through college. And I married a really awful man I met in college, and had his son, and he was, fortunately for me, so awful that I left him. And when I left him was when I really started going completely down the tubes, and found my way from Kentucky to St. Louis to California. And I arrived in Los Angeles on my birthday, August 22nd, and 1971. And by December, a lot of people in meetings used to, I don't know if they, I don't hear it so much anymore, but they used to talk about being hip, slick, and cool and all of that. Well, I was never hip, slick, and cool. I got to California, and it was so fast for me that I was, within 4 months, I needed to get clean. And okay, my husband's walking in the door. Hi, honey. I'm speaking in the meeting. By December, I hit bottom, and I started out, and see, this is where things are so different now. It's, it's almost 50 years later, and the fellowship was then not what it is today. And so I started out in OA, and in OA, the ladies gathered around me, and they heard all my pill bottles rattling in my purse, And they started talking to me about this thing they heard of, this that would be good for me. And it had a new program for people who use drugs called Narcotics Anonymous. And they just kept talking until one of them broke through my denial, and I heard what she was saying. And the next day, I looked up Narcotics Anonymous in the phone book. And at that point in time, the World Service number, phone number, was housed at Impact House, which it was a halfway house. It was what they told me, it was the first halfway house that was using Narcotics Anonymous as their program. And so they've structured it all around what we do. And the guy, whose name was Nolan, answered the phone, and I said, "I'd like to know if you have anything for people who use drugs like I do." And that's when he said that we don't care what you use, who your connections were, how much money you have, etc. He said all of that, and I was stunned, because I thought I was going to be, I was on the phone and I thought I was going to get a runaround, but I didn't. And the next thing was, he asked for my phone number. I guess at the beginning of the conversation, he asked for my phone number, and I gave it to him routinely. And then he said, "Well, you can come on over and we'll help you." And I said, "Well, I'm going to go. I'm supposed to go on vacation. I'm going to visit family in Northern California, but I'll call you when I get back." And he said, "Well, if I don't hear from you, I'll call you." And when I got off the phone, that was so big in my heart that if I don't hear from you, I'll call you. I could not remember a time in my life when somebody cared enough what was happening to me. And it's like it rang a bell inside me. And by, I don't know, that afternoon, I called him back and said, "I'll be there tomorrow." I canceled my trip. My family was mad at me, but hell, they were always mad at me, so it didn't really matter. And because this man said he cared what happened, and he had a program, we have a program that works under all conditions for all people. So I went over to Impact House. They let me stay. And this is, I guess, the next difference, because World Service is a big deal now, and it wasn't then. It was just a telephone, and that was housed at a halfway house. And so the next difference was is that there was no basic text. There was no literature. We used the other fellowships' literature, and so that day, after the morning meeting where we read from a Hazelden book, that day a woman asked me if I wanted to take the third step, and I didn't know what we were doing, but we went into the bathroom and got on our knees on the floor and read this third step out of the other fellowships' literature. And for me, that was a dramatic spiritual experience that was like hit by, I don't know, struck by lightning, spiritual experience, dramatic. Everything in my world changed, and for the first time in my life, I had hope. And for me, it's never been just about drugs. It was I didn't know how to live in the world. I didn't know how to exist with all the pain that I carried inside of me and all the problems I had and all the meanness I had experienced. I did not know how to live without drugs, and then I didn't know how to live with drugs. So I had that spiritual experience, and I had hope, but also I thought I was, see, your video's off, so you can't see that I'm halfway pretty. I'm at least attractive. But at the time, I thought I was so ugly. I was like Elephant Man, big scars and bumps all over my face, ugly. I really felt like I was physically deformed, ugly. And when I went home that night, not only did I have hope that my life was going to improve, but I also looked in the mirror and went, "Oh my God, she's pretty." I couldn't even claim it, but that was big of, I couldn't claim it as I'm pretty, but oh my God, she's pretty. But that was the beginning of me learning to live in the world and understanding that God had done for me what I couldn't do for myself. And so I went back to Impact House that evening to go to the meeting. And this is the next thing that was different than it is today. There are so many NA meetings. We have this multitude of choices. But back then, there were maybe one or two NA meetings in all of Los Angeles County any night. I mean, a week. I'm sorry, one or two a week. And so they took me to an AA meeting. And that reading that we read in here was written a little differently then. And it was the oldest known drug. Alcohol is the oldest known drug, is what they said. And so they took us to an AA meeting, and Nolan pulled me aside and said, listen, they're kind of sensitive about us, and so we need you to raise your hand as an alcoholic in the meeting. And I did, but I thought that they were going to throw me out. I really did feel like that somebody out there were going to spot me and as if I didn't belong there. And so that separation for me of alcohol versus drugs was big. And while I didn't drink or take drugs, my whole first year I had the obsession to drink until I surrendered to the fact that I too have a problem with alcohol. And now in a way that we explain it is so much better. You know, I love the way we do the first step, which says, I'm powerless over my addiction, and that includes everything. And you know, and all the ways that I can indulge in addictive behavior. But then it was different. So that was my first meeting. I was not well behaved. Again, all of us in NA in Los Angeles went to AA meetings and NA meetings, and we all went to the same ones. So I lived in Hollywood, and I went to the Hollywood meetings, which were very glamorous and with movie stars and all that stuff. I was from Kentucky, and I grew up poor, and I was really impressed, but they were very social, and the young people, who were composed of mostly addicts, the young people had a lot of social events, and I went to them all, and happily went to them all. And that was the second thing that impressed me was the laughter and how we laugh at ourselves. And it wasn't mean-spirited, ha, 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 laughing at you, but more good-natured laughing at our foibles and our, you know, and being able to accept who and how I am in the world. And that was really important. And so anyway, I was 26. I dated a lot. I had a lot of wonderful fun. And I eventually met the man that I married. I met David Russell, who's dead now, but I met David Russell in an NA meeting and an AA meeting. We were playing, you know, flirting across the room in meetings. This was the meeting that was the next place the World Service phone was housed, was at the Crenshaw House, which was, I think it's in some of the historical literature. But anyway, that was a big Saturday night NA meeting. And he stood up and insulted everybody in the room. And I fell in love. And that should tell you where my head was at. You know, he was obnoxious. David was obnoxious and outspoken and charismatic. And, you know, wherever he was, people paid attention. And I paid attention, and he paid attention to me. And so we did fall in love, and we got married, and we had a child, and things were moving ahead. And we had an extremely difficult child, and a very hard to raise child. And that's one of the places I had to work very hard to work a program, because I didn't have any parenting skills, and he didn't have any parenting skills, and I didn't want to harm my child. I didn't want to be mean and spiteful and harsh and abusive to my child. And so I got to work my program on that. And it starts with step one. I was powerless over my son, and not just my life, but his life was unmanageable by me. And then I would get to see, and I would write all this out. I mean, I'm very big on writing. You know, you write your steps, and you can write your steps on anything that's going on in your life right now. And so right then it was my son. And then I got to look at all the ways that I was behaving insane in regard to being my son's mother. And for me, a lot of it was that I couldn't say no. You know, I felt like any time I said no to him, I was being mean and abusive. And so I had to learn how to say no and set limits on him with, you know, and that there's good limits and then there's mean. And I had to learn the difference. And so then I would turn him over to my higher power and turn him over to his higher power, because, and that became a big deal when he became a teenager and was just outrageous. But, and so I would do just four and five, and then, you know, and then ask God to, you know, help me see the defects and let them go. And if I had to make amends, if I had done something, that I thought was wrong, I got to say I was sorry. And then I got to do it all over again, starting with 10, 11, and 12. So we were moving along, and life was, you know, I think I, the next area of my life I worked on was employment. I might have had a master's degree and been a school teacher, but I you know, I wrecked my career. So I had trashed it, just like we all do, and or most of us do. And so I had to start over. So we were on welfare, I went to the welfare department, and I said, to the welfare worker, I want to go back to work. And she said, well, you don't really have to. Your child's not five. And I said, well, yeah, I know, but we don't have enough money, and I want to go back to work. And so she sent me to take a test. And I took this test, and I passed this test for a job that I have to tell you I was completely unqualified for. And so I ended up going to the interview, and I was interviewed with a panel of people to interview me for a job that I knew nothing about and I was completely unqualified for. And I did so badly that they were nice, and it was humiliating. I mean, you know, I felt a lot of shame. And so as I was leaving, I left the building, and before I even got to the car, I'm crying. And I'm crying hysterically at how humiliated I felt. And in the car, I surrendered. And I said, okay, God, I will do whatever you put in my path. And 2 days later, 1 or 2 days later, I don't know how else. It was really fast after that. But the welfare worker showed up at our house, and we didn't have a telephone, because welfare, really, when you're on welfare for real, it's not enough money for anything. But we didn't have a telephone, so she showed up at the house, and she sent me to school. She wanted me to go to school. And what she wanted me to go to school for was a prepare professional drug and alcohol counseling class that was supposedly the first of its kind. And it was at the YMCA in Hollywood. And so they would pay my babysitter and gas money. So I went to this class, and I've often thought back on things like that, where this awful humiliating experience caused me to say yes to an opportunity that I would have said no to. See, I wasn't a prayer professional. I was a woman, a professional with a master's degree, but I had been so humiliated in that interview that I was willing to take what God sent me. And of course, that class led to a job, which led to another job, which led to another job in another school. And, you know, it led to me growing professionally, but it started with me surrendering to my higher power's will. And, you know, it would be really, really nice if surrender was unicorns and rainbows and glitter. You know, it would be really nice if surrender was happy, 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 but it's not. Surrender is fucking painful. And the best that I've been able to do to avoid some of that surrender pain is to recognize that I need to surrender sooner. And so anyway, Oh my goodness, that's I think. How much story time do you want me to talk? Because I can go on forever, 48 years is a long time of life.
Keep trucking, Nora. At least another 20 minutes, sweetheart. So
Okay,
please.
okay. So, thank you. So, anyway, eventually I went back to school and I got a master's degree and a professional therapist license, and I passed the psychology. I got this PhD and I passed the written test for the psychologist license, but I never made it through the orals. And at the same time that I was doing all that schoolwork, the man that I was madly in love with, which was my husband David, fell off a cliff. And he fell off a 150-foot cliff in Palos Verdes, California. And it was even in the newspaper. It was a big deal. And I can say it kind of blithely now, but let me tell you, it was awful. He fell off a cliff and he broke something in his back, but he evidently kept enough of his wits about him to slide most of the time instead of rolling down, or he would have died. But he broke some stuff in his back, and he's an addict. He was an addict, and he's dead now. So I'll just shorten the story pretty, we did everything, tried to do everything to keep him out of the kind of drug doctor's offices that eventually got their grips on him. But someone from the program sent us to an orthopedist who was one of those doctors. And that was like a year later. He'd gone to chiropractic care until chiropractors said they couldn't help him anymore. This particular surgeon did surgeries to set up the next surgery, to set up the next surgery, to set up the next surgery. And he, in the beginning, he would put David in the hospital for like 30 days at a time on high doses of morphine. And I remember sitting, and this is really important to me, I remember sitting in his hospital room when he changed from David, the man I loved, into David Dauphine. And I cannot describe to you how heartbroken I was, or the nightmare that we went through from then on until he died. But my God is really something else. My God, you think you don't know when things happen to you, the long-term benefits to you. Because David's awful experiences saved my life later. I don't know when it was. I was first diagnosed with fibromyalgia. It's a con Fibromyalgia is a chronic pain condition, and they want to give you all kinds of drugs for that. But I don't take them. I didn't take them then, and I don't take them now. There are alternatives. You can use exercise, and you can meditate, and you can do all kinds of positive stuff for yourself. I don't know, 12, 15 years ago, I'm really terrible at dates, and I was terrible at dates and numbers before I got old. So at any rate, somewhere, I was diagnosed with lymphoma. David had died, I don't know how many years before, and I was now in New Mexico, and I had just met my current husband. And that's a fun story. We met on the internet and it's all flirty and stuff, but it really isn't, going to help you. So, anyway, I met him, but I was diagnosed with lymphoma. And at that time, I thought, lymphoma is a pretty serious thing. I could die from this. And I thought, well, if I die, I've lived a really damn good life. And I guess I want to amplify that for a few minutes and say that, being clean and having a program to work has allowed someone like me from my background to have this rich, full life that would never, ever have happened people like me with from my background, push shopping carts and mumble to themselves across the street. Okay. And so when I was diagnosed with lymphoma and knew I could die, I was pretty grateful for the life I have led. And needless to say, I didn't die. But along the way, the first thing, the first thing that drug addicts think of when you say you have cancer is, oh, you can smoke pot. Well, I didn't need pot. Okay. The second thing the doctor thought was, if I'm going to have chemo, which I did, I need Ativan because obviously I'm going to be nervous. Well, I didn't. And, at each turning point, I could have drugs that I didn't need, I didn't want. And I think, what David went through and how I watched him become change from that outrageous man who insulted an entire room full of people to the pitiful person he was when he died. I didn't want that. I don't want that. I know what happens. You die from drugs, you die way before your body does. Your spirit dies, your personality goes, all the things that make you are gone. And I watched that and that helped me. The second cancer I had was more recent. That was about 7 years ago. I had lung cancer and I had surgery and they wanted to, God, they pumped me so full of shit. I tell you, I had to scream at them to take those drugs. They had them in a tube in my back where my lung was, and I was screaming at them, take this out. I do not want this. And they demanded when I went home, they demanded I take, narcotics home, and I didn't want them. And they said, well, you got to have it. We're going to just give you a small amount, just in case, because this is going to be really bad. Well, you know what? It wasn't. And here's what I really think is that I think that the drugs themselves make the pain worse. And yes, when I had surgery, I let them knock me out. I certainly didn't have it, I didn't when I had the biopsy, the lung biopsy, I let them put me to sleep. Yes, I did. That's anesthesia. When I had the part of my lung taken out, I let them put me to sleep. But I didn't need ongoing pain meds. I just didn't. Advil's a better painkiller than most of the narcotics they want to give you. And I'm speaking really strong and forceful because I saw what happened to David. And I don't want to lose my life. I don't want to be turned into a pitiful human being. I kind of like myself today. And that's the other part of being clean is that, things, life is good and life is bad and life sucks sometimes and life is good and good things happen and bad things happen and it just kind of comes and goes. But along the way, I have this program to work that allows me to live through everything with dignity. And God, I'm running out of stuff to say. So I think I'm going to shut up now and say thank you for asking me to share, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, Laura.
You're welcome. Thanks,
Thank you,
Laura.
Laura.
Great, that was awesome.